Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're going to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing pretty well.
You know, I want to talk briefly. We have Alan Tardy coming on. He's an expert in Italy. He owned the restaurant Falonico in New York City for a long time. He's cooked at some great restaurants.
Written a book called Romancing the Vine.
Has been living in Italy for the last couple of years. Wrote a really great memoir about that. Deals with food and wine and romance in Italy. We'll talk with him a little bit later. But I want to talk about something that I think is very interesting. We've recently made some changes to our restaurant on the street presence of our restaurant. Mm-hmm. And it got me to thinking about one of the things that we did. We opened Catherine Lombardi kind of quietly. And we got some great reviews, but they didn't
Not that quietly. We talked about it on the radio.
Well, but I mean, we haven't done a big media push.
Right. There's not been a mass market.
And we even didn't install all of the things on the street presence that we wanted to, because we didn't want to get hit with a lot of walk-in business until we were sure that we could handle it. So we installed the last bit of what goes on the outside of the building and the signage. And it really has made a huge difference. We put a backlit sign up for our cocktail bar. It says Catherine Lombardi Cocktail Bar.
Right, a great old kind of Art Deco-y kind of sign on
It was
street.
Designed by the Martini Group. They mm-hmm. advertised on the show. Right. Megan Martini is the head of that group, and they did a beautiful, beautiful job on it. And we also put in what's called a gobo. You don't see these much in Jersey. I have seen them in New York a lot, but this was in our plan. We've had it for a year. We finally put it up, and it projects light onto the sidewalk, and it says, you know, Catherine Lombardi Cocktail Bar, and points people upstairs.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it strikes me that different restaurants have a different idea of a street presence, and we're happy with where we are now. We left it with a mild street presence before.
Well, there's a second issue that I think Catherine Lombardi has, because it's a second-floor restaurant.
Right. Well, absolutely. But then it got me to thinking about a few restaurants in Manhattan that purposefully, actually cocktail lounges, that purposefully don't have a street presence.
No signage.
And the first is, of course, Milk and Honey, which is a place that where they change the phone number. They just want it to be for people who are very civilized, for people who are sort of in the know. And the door isn't even marked. You have to call ahead and sort of, you know, give the secret knock.
Yeah, that's the place I get lost at every time I'm try and find it, for sure.
That's the extreme place.
Yeah.
But another is the Pegu Club, which you've heard us talk about a lot. And they're not quite so secretive.
Also on the second floor.
But they're listed in the phone book. But it's just a door.
And a doorman.
And it says the Pegu Club on the door, no big sign. And I think that goes for a different kind of a feeling to it.
You know, there's another cocktail place that has a very similar kind of thing. It's called Employees Only. It's got a small awning, little logo right on the outside of the awning, and almost no street presence whatsoever. Until you kind of push the curtain back and walk through the door, you have no idea what's going on inside.
And Angel Share in Manhattan as well.
Again, also on the second floor, a lot of these have in common.
And tucked in the back of a Japanese restaurant. Mm-hmm. And it says in very small letters, Angel Share on the awning. And if you don't know where you're going, you're not going to find it.
Can I tell you something?
What?
It says it's so small on the awning of Angel Share that I've never actually seen that.
Oh, really? You know it's there.
I've never noticed it, ever.
But I think that how you experience a restaurant begins on the street. When you pull up to the Manor in West Orange for your big fancy schmancy wedding, I mean, you pull into the manicure driveway, there's the stone thing that says the Manor.
And the Manor looks very castle-esque as you pull up to it.
And it's the other thing that's very interesting is one of the reasons that restaurants are so good for a city, I think, and New Brunswick, which is, let's just say, completely revitalized now and a very vital city indeed, used restaurants to help revitalize the city. Restaurants especially that are, you know, upscale casual to upscale, you need to maintain your street presence, and the experience of your restaurant begins when someone sees your restaurant. And
As they drive past.
That's why you see people, you know, restaurateurs, we still sweep the sidewalk and, you know, we repaired our own sidewalk just recently where it was a little bit damaged, because it's got to be perfect, and it's got to be perfect from the street in. And you as a restaurateur need to present an image.
And when you're talking about signage, as far as the outdoor cafe of my restaurant, frankly, not it doesn't generate very much income. It's kind of hard to maintain. It adds some service difficulties because it's not inside the building, but it is so important to the signage of what we do in summertime to have that kind of streetscape of people enjoying themselves outside that's why we invest so much into the outdoor cafe, for instance, of our restaurants. And other people in New Brunswick are obviously doing exactly the same thing.
Well, and I recall when they first began with the outdoor cafe. In New Brunswick, they had an outdoor cafe ordinance. And for a long time, it was almost free to have an outdoor cafe. It costs a little bit now. But when New Brunswick was a challenging downtown to have a business in, putting people on the streets really added to the...
It gave it a very European feel, and both Francis and I have spent a lot of time in Europe, and there are constantly people sitting out in the streetscape in Europe, and whether it's in the morning time and they're having their coffee, or it's in the afternoon time and they're having some lunch, or it's dinner time and they're not having dinner and they're getting drunk. It doesn't matter. They're out on the street. And there are constantly people in your outdoor cafe, as long as the weather permitting, outside, enjoying the weather, enjoying the passersby, and giving the passersby a sense of community.
Well, and that also speaks to the outdoor cafe, not only being on the streetscape, people like to be outside. You know, Barbara Shin and David Page, who own Home Restaurant in Manhattan, and they also own Shin Vineyards out on Long Island, those guys have this little outdoor cafe in the back. Very charming restaurant, great food. They have this little outdoor cafe in the back, and it's really in the back of their building on Cornelia Street in Manhattan. And it's enclosed.
A little courtyard.
And it's a courtyard, and it's enclosed all around with on one side by their building and then on three sides by high wooden fencing. Even on the coldest of nights, there are people who want to eat outside. And because it's so enclosed, they have a couple of heaters. And rain,
and it retains heat,
snow, whatever.
You can eat back there anytime. It's true.
They have it,
or nearly any time.
On their coldest nights, they have, I think they call it the Polar Bear Club. They used to give you a little, button if you go out there and.
Yeah, what I really want when I go outside on those cold nights is a parka. Okay, I don't want a button. Don't give me a button.
It's warm. You just got to get into your spot and sit there. You know.
Yeah, it's eating outside is just one of those things that makes you feel very free, very enjoying the open air. There's really something to that.
When I was in Seville as a young man in Seville in Spain, there was right where the cathedral, the catedral is right in the middle of the city. It's huge. And there are cafes. Just the street comes to a T. It ends at the cathedral and goes right and left. And they have lines painted where the street itself comes in a big plaza. Mm-hmm. And there are lines where the traffic goes down the middle and then has to make a right or a left. Within these painted lines, the cafes on the corner sit tables. You're basically part of the parking.
I love it.
The cars speed by you on the center, and they speed by you on the
right.
You know
what? I so much prefer to be sitting outside in the hustle and bustle of the streetscape than in, like a lot of restaurants are doing now, to be sitting in the kitchen in the hustle and bustle of the kitchen.
I guess
because I get to see it every day, I much prefer to see what's going on outside and what people are doing with their lives.
But in Sevilla, the waiters actually have to cross the street every time they bring you a drink because you're right out in the middle of traffic. It's really kind of wild.
Well, and you can see your waiter coming, so it's okay.
Yes.
So you don't feel like, he's taking too long.
Exactly. We'll be talking in just a moment with Alan Tardy about his book about life in Italy. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurant. Today we're joined by Alan Tardy. His book is Romancing the Vine, Life, Love, and Transformation in the Vineyards of Barolo. Alan began his career cooking in New York at restaurants like Chanterelle and La Madre. He owned his own restaurant for 10 years, crazy man, called Filonico in New York City. He's published his book. He's come to join us to talk to us about finding and falling in love with a village in Italy and a love in Italy and wine and food.
Alan, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Tell us a little bit about your adventure, and this book is part memoir, is it not?
It is. It's a combination memoir, travelogue, wine manual with 25 recipes to boot.
It sounds like it's 4,000 pages.
Well, it felt like that sometimes when I was writing it, but it's actually just a little bit over 300.
Well, Now, this is where you go and after closing your restaurant in New York, you move to Castiglione Falletto in the Barolo region of Piedmont.
Yes. It wasn't quite that direct, but I did wind up there after making a lot of trips back and forth.
Let's talk about that time period in your life July, August, September of 01.
Because it's a very romantic thing. I mean, every time Mark goes away to another country, I hope he decides to stay, but he keeps coming back. So give us a couple of pointers. How did you wind up in Castiglione?
He keeps hoping I find love abroad.
Basically, I did just what most people do, but I didn't. At a certain point, I decided not to come back for a while. I was just traveling back and forth, and this is post 9/11. Things in New York were kind of a little bit low, to put it mildly, not too many new projects taking place, and I was, I had an opportunity to go back and forth to Italy, and at a certain point I just said to myself, this could be a great opportunity to stay here for a while and see what it's actually like to live in a place rather than just visit.
So that happens to everybody who visits Italy, and they say, we should just stay here, honey.
Right.
But in my case, they don't do it.
In my case, it was a unique combination of factors. I mean, my restaurant was closed by my own choice after almost 10 years. And because of what happened at 9/11 and the effect that had, not just on New York City, but on the entire country, obviously, but there were not really any new opportunities to do a new restaurant project. So in a certain sense, it was this combination of things that really gave me the unusual opportunity to say, you know what, I'm going to stay for a while. So once I decided to do that, I rented out my apartment here, and found a place in the little village where I had been visiting for some time, and I did it.
The
year became 2 years, and now, I mean, I still have my place there, and I've actually become an Italian citizen and a resident of my little village.
I read the story. Seriously, I want to talk a little bit about, because I think that maybe some people don't realize, some people who aren't in the restaurant business, why you would close a restaurant that's successful, that's been going for 10 years, what would be the motivation there? And I think that Francis and I probably have some perspective there.
Right.
But people may not understand, it's succeeding, it's going well. Why would you close it?
Right. Well, and I mean, the ironic thing, too, is that when we opened in 1992 on 24th Street and 5th Avenue, in what is now known as the Flatiron District, then it was just really a little black hole in between Gramercy Park and Murray Hill and Chelsea. There was really nothing there. Now it's changed quite a bit. But, what happened with me was, frankly, I just got tired. I mean, I was the chef, and I was the owner, and I was actually working in the kitchen on the line, lunch and dinner, and working in the office in between. And I loved it. But after a while, it just started to kind of catch up with me, and I started to feel like I was getting, a little bit burnt out, and I didn't want that to translate into our customers' experience. We cultivated a really great rapport with our customers. We had a wonderful clientele over the years, and I didn't want to spoil that.
Just so everybody knows, the restaurant was Filonico in New York, and I went there several times, and it was terrific.
I think people sometimes don't realize that in every life, to really enjoy life, there has to be some balance, and there are so many people in this industry who go into the restaurant business kind of expecting that they're going to have that balance, and when it's not achieved, that can be very disconcerting. And you keep thinking, I think, a lot of people in the business, that, well, next year I'll have more balance.
Right.
And
I think that can happen with a lot of fields, but especially in the restaurant business, where we're trying to really provide pleasure to people and great food, and which involves a certain amount of creativity and fine service and a warm welcome. When we're giving them hospitality, once you start to get tired and it's not fresh anymore, then you really feel it. Maybe in other fields it's not quite as apparent, or it's not quite as damaging, perhaps. But once you lose that passion in the restaurant business, I think it's kind of time to move on to something else.
I agree, especially in small places. I mean, it is all about hospitality, which is about opening up your living room and sharing of yourself. When we come back, we're going to be talking more with Alan Tardy about his book, Romancing the Vine, Life, Love, and the Transformations in the Vineyards of Barolo. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1125.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space.
Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. Our guest is Alan Tardy. His book is Romancing the Vine, Life, Love, and Transformation in the Vineyards of Barolo. What was so personally you pick up, you sell your restaurant in New York, you move to Piedmont, and I think you spoke Italian all along?
I did speak Italian.
But
there's nothing like living in a place for an extended period of time where no one else speaks English to kind of
right, that'll hone your skills in a hurry.
It was funny because I myself took a bunch of years in high school and college of French, and then all of a sudden I moved to France and I lived with a family that didn't speak English.
Right.
And I realized how little I actually knew.
Can I tell you that I took two semesters of college Spanish, knew basically nothing. And I moved. I was in Spain for a while, and what taught me Spanish was, number one, I realized it was the only way that I could talk to Spanish girls, and number two,
that's not the only way, but
well, yeah, exactly. it was the quickest way, or the most successful way, it turned out to be. And the other thing is, frankly, I think a couple of glasses of wine really helps loosen up the tongue in learning a foreign language.
I know that a couple of glasses of wine helps you loosen up your tongue. That's for sure.
Now you move to Piedmont.
Yes.
And what was so transforming about the space and the way of life, and what happens to you there? How did you make a living?
Well, I think what was transforming about it were a lot of things. One thing was that for myself, as someone who has long loved wine and been familiar with it, and, you know, I did all the selecting of wines at my restaurant and recommending bottles to people, and a lot of tasting with magazines and some writing. But once I actually got, and I had been to the area before, kind of passing through, but once I actually got out into the vineyards, face-to-face with the vines, and working, you know, having an opportunity to work in the vineyards through the entire annual process from the very first pruning all the way through to harvest and what happens afterwards, it really changed my whole perspective on what appears in front of you in the glass.
Mm-hmm.
For me, before I really got out into the vineyards on a regular basis, wine was something that kind of started in the bottle and went from there. And I knew intellectually what the process of pruning was about and vinification, but I hadn't really experienced it. So that really was transforming for me from a wine standpoint.
You know, Francis and I talk about this a lot, and it's kind of, especially as Americans, we're so disconnected from the agricultural part of our lives, from where our food comes, whether it's a pig farm or a grape vineyard.
Right.
We've just cut ourselves off from that for some reason.
I mean, and that was also another part of what I would say the transforming experience was actually living in a small village. I mean, I was born in Chicago and spent most of the rest of my life in New York, so I'm familiar with big cities, but here I was in, not just in Italy, but in a small village in a rural section way up in the northwest corner of the country with its own larger regional culture, but then, you know, you have this small village culture, a small town life that I had never really experienced before.
When we come back, we're going to be talking more with Alan Tardy about his book, Romancing the Vine, the memoir of his move to Italy, and we're going to talk about life and love, because you did find love of not just wine when you were in Italy. We'll be talking more about that after the news. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with The Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back.
You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal. I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Alan Tardy was a New York chef, owned restaurant Falonico, cooked at a bunch of high-end restaurants in New York, and then moved to the small village of Castiglione Falletto in the Barolo region of Italy. He's written a memoir about his experience. It's called Romancing the Vine, Life, Love, and the Transformation in the Vineyards of Barolo. Now, this is not a book just about wine. This is really a book, a memoir, and about personal transformation. You did move from New York to a small village in Italy, start working in the vineyards, and met a woman and fell in love. That's pretty cool, man. How did you integrate yourself into that society so much? You're an Italian citizen now as well. How did you integrate yourself into that society so easily?
Well, I guess, you know, getting back to where we started, it was a set of circumstances that just kind of gave me the opportunity of spending time in this place, and the rest, so to speak, just happened. And, you know, while I was in the middle of, while I was working in the vineyards, I mean, obviously there, you don't work there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week like you do in the restaurant. So there's time to do other things, and I got to know some people from the area.
Well, there's, and we talked about this a little bit in the last segment, but there's really something to be said about putting yourself into the culture of a place as opposed to just visiting it.
It's not always possible for many of us to do, and certainly I had taken many trips, even right through this very area, because it's right in the heart of the Barolo region. Great food, great wine. So naturally, I mean, most people who have an interest in Italian food will make a pilgrimage there at some point. But I had never really had an opportunity to kind of, you know, stop and look around and settle in a little bit and really get a little bit into the rhythm of that local life. And and that's, you know, one thing that was really interesting to me between my work in the vineyards, which I said really kind of changed my perspective on wine, and the experience of living in a small community, which happened to be in this unusual region of Piedmont. And then, so you know, you have the cultural and the viticultural, and then you also have the emotional stuff that all somehow became blended together.
Now, you went and worked there, and you had gone from being the chef owner of a restaurant, because one of the things, I mean, many of our friends are restaurateurs, we're restaurateurs. The thing about being a chef or a restaurateur, you need to have a certain amount of ego, you know, and
right.
You really took a step down, or in some senses a step down, and you went from being the chef owner directing the whole show for
right.
10 years to not really playing that role as a, you know, worker in the vineyards. How did that work for yourself?
You know, it was okay. I mean, for me, I didn't look at it as really taking a step down necessarily. I kind of viewed it as a whole new experience. And for me, I mean, it was a liberating experience. After do I need to say almost 20 years? Or I mean, a long many years in the restaurant business, working in small closed kitchens. I mean, sometimes, you know, we all know this. Many chefs, you never see many people work in restaurants, sometimes you don't see the light of day, and you're in often cramped, noisy, hot conditions for a lot of time. I did that for years and years and years. So here I found myself, and after all of this stuff that got me there, out in the open, in the vineyards, and within the beautiful surroundings, working with vines that grow grapes for a wine that I happen to love and have for some time. The vines don't talk back. I mean, it was a really great experience, and I was learning stuff, complete, you know, different things, using my hands still, but a whole different set of skills, and I found that very exhilarating. It didn't, you know, so it didn't really matter that, technically speaking, I was a manual laborer. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was doing like, you know, grunt work basically.
I think sometimes you can learn a lot by being mindful of doing something mindless.
You definitely can, and I think any good cook knows that out of, you know, doing the simplest chores and tasks and the most repetitive things, if you do it with an open mind, and you can always learn something. And when you do something for the first time, however simple or mundane it may be, if it's kind of connected to something that's of interest to you, it can be really, really fascinating and even enlightening in some ways.
Now, you then went and you got Italian citizenship. How difficult was that? I mean, do you have Italian ancestry that
yes.
made it easier?
Yes. Well, that made it possible. I mean, without that, it would have been you probably would have had to get married.
Yeah, you spend a little time in the book talking about the bureaucracy there in the Italian government, which as I think a lot of people might expect of the Italian government, doesn't always go exactly the way it should.
Let's just say they're not the Germans.
Yeah. Well, I mean, bureaucracy is bureaucracy, and it's I kind of talk a lot in the book about this whole sort of once I got my citizenship and I found out that I was really entitled to it, and it's pretty clear. I mean, if you have a second or third generation ancestor by blood, according to Italian law, you're already a citizen. You just need to acquire the necessary documentation to prove that.
So as long as your grandparents were citizens, or could your great-grandparents count?
I think
too?
It's up back... it could be the third, up to the third generation.
Wow, Ireland, it's only grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
That's wild. So, when you became an Italian citizen, did that change the way that you were able to? Did that change what you were able to do in the course of your travels and your job? And
well, it certainly did. It eventually gave me an Italian passport, so I'm a member not just of Italy but also of the entire European community. I could work anywhere in Europe. So it opened up other opportunities like that, but I just kind of kept doing what I was doing.
Well, and now you've come back and you worked with, I understand you worked with Mario Batali and the Bastianiches in opening Del Posto?
Yes, I helped out there on a consulting basis for the opening.
We were there, within a week or two of when it opened?
We were also supposed to go yesterday, but we had a meeting run long, so we didn't get to go.
What a lovely, lovely place that is.
Yeah, I was there for the first 2 months before we opened, and about the 3 months after, once kind of everything got running in its groove and the bulk of the reviews had come in and things had sort of settled down, my work there was done. Because I was really just brought in to kind of help out with the opening.
Now, in Romancing the Vine, which is mostly a memoir, there are 25 recipes as well. Why are they there and why did you choose those recipes?
Well, the recipes are the classic regional dishes of Piedmont, and I thought that they should be included because the food, like the wine and the culture, is a big part of what defines a place. I mean, aside from the other things, it is very much a wine manual that kind of talks through the entire process of working with vines as it's done in Piedmont to try to demonstrate how wine really is not just a beverage, but it's an expression of a particular place. And the food, the regional indigenous food, is really the same type of expression of a place. So that's why the recipes are not really mine. Those are classic recipes that were given to me mostly by local cooks, some of them home cooks, some professional cooks. And those are the classic dishes you'll see in many restaurants throughout Piedmont.
Well, the food and wine of a region generally are developed over, especially in when you talk about European regions, they're developed over a long period of time based on, well, what foods go with which grapes that are indigenous to here. And,
right, what ingredients are available mm-hmm. locally.
And what's available locally, precisely.
And those are things that are passed. They tend to be passed down through generations, and you'll have certain dishes that are specific to one very small region. And, you know, I mean, there's a strength to those things. I always found regional cooking in general, but specifically regional cooking of Italy, to be a great source of inspiration because those things have become traditional dishes. There's a reason why they're maintained because there's something that's compelling or strong and very satisfying about them.
Well, you know, it's funny. I think there's a great distinction between the people who, in the cities like in New York, we have regional Italian restaurants, but you still have that Italian, quote unquote, Italian or Southern Italian or Northern Italian restaurant that really has very little to do with the regional cooking of Italy.
Right.
In the United States, it's more of an Italian American sort of.
Yeah, that's true. Because if anyone has actually had an opportunity to travel to different parts of Italy, you kind of realize that it's really not a question of north or south. It's just 20 different regions of Italy, and each of them has its own history and culture and cuisine and architecture and language or dialect. In Piedmont, for example, there's a very strong regional dialect. So mm-hmm. it's really like, you know, 20 different countries, and to say north or south is a really arbitrary distinction that doesn't tell you a whole lot.
You know, Alan, there are some big changes happening in the wine world in Barolo. When we come back, I'd really like to talk about those with you.
Excellent.
Right. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
Floors, walls, and lighting. The Restaurant Guys learned long ago that the key to making a space look great are floors, walls, and lighting. There's no tougher test to a carpet than a busy restaurant. From design to installation to cleaning, the Gillespie Group has handled the Restaurant Guys restaurant floors for more than 10 years. Designers know what looks great on the first day. Bob Gillespie knows what will continue to look great year after year. Gillespie doesn't just install carpets. Their quality clean division has experience and expertise to keep that carpet looking great. In our business, it's the details that matter. In your home or office, the details make a lasting impression. The Gillespie Group handles projects from large hotels to offices right down to your living room. Look down. Go on, look down. Right there by your feet. You see. You need the Gillespie Group. Call them at 732-254-5508 or visit them at thegillespiegroup.com. Tell them the Restaurant Guys sent you and get a free cleaning with any installation. Remember, it's Gillespie for carpet and flooring, 732-254-5508.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick. And our guest today is Alan Tardy, who spent the last couple of years living in the Piedmont region of Italy and has written a memoir about it. You should pick it up. You can find out how to do that on our website, restaurantguysradio.com.
So, Alan, Francis and I talk a lot about the fact that kind of the soul of the wine world is being fought over in places just like Barolo. You know, these wines, there are some real staunch traditions, and you talk about, you know, some of the winemakers in your book. Bartolo Mascarello is one that comes to mind.
I love him.
Who, you know, talked about, you know, I make the wines that my father made.
Right.
And he made the wines that his father made, and we continue to make them. I'm a winemaker because that's what I do.
Right.
And then there are new guys who are coming in who say, you know, the hell with that. Let's just make wine that's like California Cabernet and everybody's going to love it.
Right.
That's charged language. I sort of framed the debate there. I'm sorry. But what's going on in Italy? What's the difference between old-fashioned vineyards and people who are doing new stuff?
Well, there's a lot, needless to say, there's a lot going on in Piedmont, just like there is in a lot of other areas of Italy. However, Piedmont is one of the most prestigious wine areas of the country, so what happens there makes a big difference. I mean, one thing that I would say is that part of what the transforming part we were talking about that I've referred to in my book is just sort of change over time. I mean, if you look at how winemaking has changed over the years, and I talk a lot about how the wine, how Barolo as a wine was actually came about in that area.
Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about how Barolo came about?
Well, actually, I mean, Nebbiolo, the Nebbiolo grape from which Barolo was made, has been there since ancient times. But up until about the middle of the 19th century, it was primarily a kind of sweet, pink, fizzy wine that hadn't quite finished its fermentation. Piedmont is right on the border of France, and there was, of course, around this time, a lot of back and forth between of the sort of noble families. In fact, Piedmont was ruled by the House of Savoy, which was a French royal house. And actually, at a certain point, some of these nobles had their castles out in the Langhe, what's called the Langhe area of Piedmont. They grew wine, along with a lot of other agricultural
products,
commodities. But the wine wasn't really very good. These people were familiar with French wine, which was there. I mean, winemaking all came from the same place. Romans brought it over, but monks had been making wine in France for much longer, and so it was a much more evolved thing in France. Mm-hmm. So these people came to found themselves in Italy and with these vineyards making kind of mediocre wine. And so they basically revolutionized the whole thing. And this all happened at a very specific point in time, which just happened to kind of coincide with the unification of Italy and formation of Italy as a modern country. So it's really quite interesting.
You know, the other thing that's very interesting about the Nebbiolo grape that makes Barolo and Barbaresco is that it's a grape that when made in the traditional way, you know, it's not this juicy, red, very obvious thing that, you know, operates on any level. And if you don't know anything about it, you pick it up and you say, wow, that's delicious.
Right.
It's sort of like the traditionally made Barolos, you got to think about it. You got to understand it. It sort of has to be explained to you. And then they can rise to tremendous levels of greatness. But there are a lot of people sort of avoiding making the traditional wines because you got to bring a little something to the table to understand them. And
right.
so they make wines that I think are simpler, that are can still be very good, but I think that something's lost when in an old traditional region like this, we make wines that, to me, look like California Cabernet. Where do you come down on that debate?
I agree with you 100%. I mean, I have a real fondness for wines that you know you might call sort of more traditional, that are kind of understated and elegant. They don't knock you over the head. They're not kind of unctuous and extracted and internationalized, if you want to use that term.
Yeah.
I would say one thing, that I think that the boundaries of modern style and traditional style are starting to get kind of broken down somewhat, because it's, you know, it 15, 20 years ago was easy. If you used barrique, you were modern. If you used big casks and didn't really keep your winery that clean, you were traditional, old-fashioned. I mean, now they're starting to get blurred, and which I think is good, because, you know, the traditionalists are employing some of the techniques of the modernists, namely reducing the yields, keeping the wineries spotlessly clean. People even inoculate with selected yeast.
You wrote an article in the Times recently on a grape called Asparinio, which
yes.
is very traditional.
Fantastic.
And very old school. Why don't you tell? Because I love that article, and actually, I think I'm the only guy in New Jersey that carries that particular wine. Why don't you tell people about Asparinio and how this very unusual grape is made?
I'm actually glad you mentioned that. Asparinio is a really fascinating grape variety and vine, and I mean, it's really, these vines only grow in one small area, about 100 hectares, just north of Naples.
That's about 220 acres.
Right. Well, yeah, there's a little bit less, you're absolutely right, a little bit less than 250 acres of these things left. The vines have been there for thousands of years. I mean, Pliny wrote about the very same vines in his Natural History in the first century A.D. And one of the most unique things about them is that it's a Greek grape, a grape that was brought over by the Greeks originally. When they brought it there in this part of Italy, they found the indigenous, the native Italians, who were the Etruscans, who had a different style of viticulture that was adapted to that place. So what Asparinio is really a living relic of a Greek grape with a Etruscan style of viticulture, and they plant these vines next to poplar trees. The vines grow up the trees and spread out on wires between them, so you have these walls of vine that are 30 feet tall.
And you harvest the vines from the trees, where the vines grow throughout the trees. We're going to be talking more about that with Alan Sardi, author of Romancing the Vine, in a recent article in the New York Times on Asparinio, in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're talking with Alan Tardi, Italian food and wine expert. We were talking about the Asparinio grape, which is grown in a very small region of Italy, that the vines are trellised through poplar trees, and the grapes have to be harvested from ladders. Isn't that right, Alan?
That's right, and I actually did that a few months ago.
But it's kind of dangerous, isn't it?
You know, it actually isn't. There's a technique that they use, and once you learn what that is, it's actually quite safe, as I found.
Alan? You've never seen me on a ladder.
I don't think they make ladders for you.
All ladders are dangerous to me.
No, but and they're having trouble finding people who can practice this craft of harvesting these grapes in this way, isn't it?
Well, they're having trouble finding people who want to harvest grapes in this way. It's not easy, and unfortunately the grapes don't really generate much revenue because no one knows about the wine.
Well, if you want to try Asparinio, you can come to Catherine Lombardi, your stage left. I actually thought the story was so cool. I had purchased it just the week before, and then it was in the New York Times. I was like, cool, someone's going to know about this, actually, rather than just me drinking all 12 bottles.
I was going to say, you and your four buddies sitting around the table going, Asparinio for everybody.
Mark, sometimes when I buy like oddball wines, he says, okay, because I'm the wine director, and he says, Francis, this wine is great and all, it's delicious. Could you buy some wines that we could sell? Wouldn't that be, you know?
Well, Asparinio is one of the many wines that definitely deserves an audience.
Well,
if
you ever find your way into Central Jersey, you and I should sit down in Catherine Lombardi, along with Mark. We'll invite him and have a glass of Asparinio.
And then we'll have 11 bottles left.
And then how about a Barolo to follow?
And nice. A Barolo to follow. Mark,
okay, that's a deal.
Nice.
Alan Tardi's book is Romancing the Vine, Life, Love, and Transformation in the Vineyards of Barolo. You can find out how to pick it up on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Alan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks
so
much,
Alan. Thank you. It's been great to talk with you.
It's a super book. We recommend that you pick it up. I enjoyed it. I'm moving to Italy.
Goodbye. See ya.
I'm actually not moving to Italy, and I don't need that much transformation. You're stuck with me.
Now I'm frowning.
I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.